Accession number 8736, rule number 23.
Take 23, Lord Harding.
It wasn't long, I think, before I came to the conclusion that we weren't going to be successful with these limited offences against Monte Cassino. And therefore, I set myself the job of writing a full-scale appreciation for the future. I came to the conclusion that, all right, Alexander's plan was to continue as long as they had any reserves. But when the reserves were exhausted, there had to be a period in which we sat down, sorted it all out, and prepared for a major offensive. And I gave myself the task of writing an appreciation. At that time, Alexander, we had these offices at the top of the Caserta Palace, and Alexander and I, and one or two others, I think Van Robertson, joined up with us then, lived in a small villa outside the palace grounds, and I used to go back after dinner each night and get on with my appreciation, because that was the best time for me to work. I wasn't interfered by the telephone, and nobody would come in bothering me and that sort of thing. So night after night for some time I went back and worked on this appreciation, which eventually formed the basis for what I call the Battle for Rome. And I worked it out to carry the armies, the Allied armies, right up to the Apennines. That was the way I worked out a plan. And that I showed to Alexander, and he discussed it and approved it, and then he arranged a meeting of army commanders and corps commanders to put it over, that's just what went on. And during that period, Brian Robertson had joined forces and with me, and we got on well together. We got to know each other well. We hadn't worked together before. He was an absolutely first-class administrative officer. He really was brilliant. And I'd also got to know and got on good terms with Al Grunter, the Chief of Staff of the Fifth Army. And, of course, I had known Oliver Leese before, and his Chief of Staff I knew, too. So I'd got a general feel of the whole thing, and I got a good start myself. I'd made one or two changes in the staff that I found, and got out in particular a chap called Hugh Mannering at BGS Operations, who was a tremendous help. I'd known him in the desert. He had been captured in the desert and then escaped. But the scene was set, as far as I was concerned, for really getting down to planning a major offensive. And that was with that intention that I wrote this, worked on and produced this appreciation. And so that formed the basis for the Battle for Rome. And, I mean, one of my major conclusions at the time was, because of the nature of the country and because of the German skill of the German forces in manipulating troops on the battlefield, and particularly in blocking operations, it would be necessary that, in addition to our superiority in the air, which was very big, almost complete air superiority, and superiority in artillery and armor. In spite of that, if we were to be successful, we had to attack the Germans on the full front between Cassino and the east and the west coast. And to do so with forces in the front line and follow-up forces, but at least 3-1 in terms of infantry. And that's become a sort of yardstick now for a set-piece battle, I think, and most people generally. Certainly it was necessary in that case because of two reasons. One, the skill of the Germans in manipulating their fortage and delaying and blocking operations, and also the very the nature of the country, the mountains and the rivers, which facilitated blocking operations. You know, that was my main conclusion. And then, of course, it came to a question of being able to. Obviously, the troops had been involved, various divisions had been involved in the casino attack. They wanted time for rest and retraining and re-equipping. The 4th Indian Division, for example, which employed the New Zealand Division, who had been involved in the casino attacks, and also the two or three divisions in the 5th Army who've been involved in the unsuccessful attacks across the Rapido. So there was a need for recruitment, regrouping, and training, and at the same time to make sure that the front was held, and also to build up between the Apennines and the West Coast a force of at least 21 divisions. When I told Brian Robertson that we would have to assemble forces of that size there in order to carry out a major offensive on that front, he said, "Well, it can't be done. There isn't room, and we can't maintain them there." I said, "Well, Brian, I know you say it's impossible. Nothing's impossible to you. I'm sure you'll do it." And he did it, and it was really a brilliant piece of administrative planning that enabled us to assemble that large force between the Apennines and the West Coast in order to carry out this major offensive. At the same time, I came to the conclusion, well, probably before that, I came to the end zero. We'll talk about that later, shall we? Certainly, we had to strengthen the follow-up forces for the Anzio landing. And for that purpose, I brought across two divisions from the 8th Army.
How short of people were you at this time? Because obviously Overlord was ongoing, wasn't it? The preparations
The preparation. No, we weren't. I think, yes, I can't remember how many divisions we had. But I didn't think. When in my appreciation, I didn't come to the conclusion that further forces were needed. I thought that we had enough forces if they were deployed and supported, logistically supported, and to fit in with this plan that I'd worked out. And which had Alexander's approval. No, we didn't. There were enough troops available in Italy at the time, but they did need time for to recover from lick their wounds and retrain and prepare for a major offensive.
Am I right in thinking, Lord Harding, that you weren't going to be content to drive the Germans back beyond Rome? You actually wanted destruction of their forces.
We wanted the concept, because that was the original concept of the Anzio landing, was to wipe out the German forces between the Apennines and the West Coast. So that really was, the concept was, an attack on the main front from Cassino to the West Coast, a full-scale offensive with enough forces to maintain the momentum and drive the Germans back, combined with, at the appropriate moment, a sortie, a very large and determined sortie from the Anzio bridgehead to block the Germans' retreat. That was the general concept of the operation. And the timing of the sortie, as I call it, from Anzio was left to be decided according to what happened on the main front. But they were fully prepared for a major offensive from Enfield, due eastward through the Auburn Hills to block the retreat of the German forces being driven back from the Casino position. That was the general concept of the whole plan. And then to carry out to keep the momentum going, and carry the armies forward, right up to the Apennines, to Florence and to the Apennines, without a pause. And that was the general concept. So the plan was a full scale attack on the main front, what I call the Casino front. A breakout from Anzio, and then the whole thing going forward through Rome, north and northwards, up to the Apennine, to Florence and the Apennines. That was the general concept and plan. And there were very mixed collection of forces. I mean, going from right to left, there was the Eighth Army with British and the Desert Air Force in support of them. Then there was the Fifth Army in between there was the Canadian Corps. There was the New Zealand Division. And it was a conglomerate army group, and this is where I think perhaps Alexander's reputation and skill paid off best, because he was able, by his personality and by his experience, to keep the whole thing together. And that, I think, in that respect, I think he made a very big contribution to the success of the rest of the Italian campaign. A very big contribution. Because waging war on an Allied basis is not an easy matter at all. I mean, we had very little experience of it. At that time, in the various headquarters, it was general rule. If there was an American staff officer in charge of a section of the staff, well, he had a British deputy, and vice versa. And Eisenhower, of course, it was, who said that everybody must be interchangeable. And that was one of his principles, which he established and worked to. And that eventually came to pass, but it took time.
Was that a good principle?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, a very good principle. Because you can't have national prejudices and ideas and emotions interfering with effective staff work or command. It is a big problem. Waging war on an Allied basis is not easy. And I remember on one occasion, it was later, When the Prime Minister was out, he came to lunch at an arm mess one day, and I remember a discussion he had with Alexander, which Alexander started by pointing out to the Prime Minister the problems and the difficulties of commanding an Allied force and waging war, what I call it, on an Allied basis. And the Prime Minister looked at him pretty hard in a minute, and he said, "Joe General, you know, there's one thing worse than having allies." And Alexander said, "Oh, what is that, sir?" And the old man said, "Having no allies." So that again, you see, is the sort of remark that Winston would make, which satisfied your doubts and anxieties. And made you feel, well, all right, that's what we've got to do. And as well as an inspiring remark, to me anyway.
Yes, you haven't told me, you know, your impressions of Winston Churchill when you met him for that first time.
Well, the first time he came out, that was the first time I'd met him, he came out to Italy for on a week's visit. And that by that time, this was later, of course, when the troops were fighting north of, between Siena and Florence. And the headquarters were then, Alexander's headquarters were then in the woods outside Siena. And we found a villa on the outskirts of Siena, which seemed suitable, and the arrangements were made for the Prime Minister and his staff to be put up there. And that was the first time I met him. The first night we went along, I went with Alex to dine with him, and he kept us talking about the conduct of the war and latest information and so on. Well after midnight. And it was all very interesting and very attractive, and I was very impressed with the Prime Minister's grasp of the overall situation and his views and ideas about the prosecution of the war. I was very impressed indeed by his wide range of knowledge and the I think probably particularly the determination, his absolute dedicated determination to win the war. Victory was all important to him. And I had met him at Marrakesh. But I was very impressed by him. Well, that night we came away, rather in the early hours of the morning. The next day I had a very busy day. And, it wasn't any more different, much different from what it usually was. But then we went along to the dinner with the Prime Minister again that evening. And I found myself sitting a little way down the table. The Prime Minister was at the end, and I put up my hand and went to sleep. And then the Prime Minister had a habit, after coffee had been served, he would clear the room of those people who weren't allowed to hear or see or read the latest top secret information and signals. And then I moved up. Several people moved out. And I moved up next but one on the Prime Minister's left. And rather foolishly, I continued my habit of putting my hand up by my head and dozing. I woke with a start. Here the Prime Minister said, "Look, Chief of Staff to sleep, stand asleep." So I woke up quickly, came to, and I said, "Oh, no, Prime Minister, I was just thinking." Whereupon he gave me a long lecture on the time to have a sleep, General. It was after lunch. "You have a sleep after lunch." I said, "Sir, I'm not, that's no good. My boss doesn't expect me to work after lunch." He said, Don't matter. You have a sleep after lunch." But he never upbraided me at all. He just encouraged me to sleep at a different time. And again, you see, that all helped and made you feel that, everything's under control and the old man's in charge and all for the best in the best of all possible worlds, and we're going to win. There's no doubt whatever with this chap at the head of our affairs, the war will be won. And that, I think, was his inspiring genius. It certainly made me feel that way. No, we did. Of course, he did. He was. He tried to influence the course of events very much, and his signals to him. He used to send signals direct to Alexander, sort of bypassing Wilson, who was Allied Force headquarters. And by that time, we were installed in Caserta Palace, their headquarters. And he used to get signals, he used to come in at all hours of the day or night, and I used to take him along to Alexander And probably if someone came in and while he was after he'd gone to bed, I wouldn't take unless I thought he was really urgent, I wouldn't take it and discuss it with him until the morning. But then what the general practice that we adopted was that the telegrams from the Prime Minister would arrive. I would let Alexander know them, show them to him, and then we decide to think about it for a few hours, and then I would draft, as we talk about it, and I would draft a reply for Alexander's approval. And on reflection, very amusing telegrams. I mean, when the Anzio landing bogged down, was just the beachhead. Telegram arrived to Alexander from the Prime Minister saying, I expected a wild dash into the mountains to cut off the enemy's retreat. What do I find? Nothing but a whale wallowing on the beach. those sort of things. And sometimes you got irritated and frustrated by them because they're obviously... they're written in dramatic style, which the Prime Minister was excelled in, but sometimes they bore no relation to the reality. And that was annoying. But after all, pretty soon you got used to them, and then Alex was an expert at fending off difficult questions, and so we got along all right.
Did it cause
mischief? One occasion, she sent out, I can't remember what it was in reply to, but it finished up by saying, I'm not at all concerned with the enemy in front. those sort of things.
Did it cause mischief between Alexander and Wilson, the fact that Winston Churchill bypassed...
Well, I don't know about it did, and probably more with Wilson's staff than with Wilson himself. It was a repetition for me, really, of the situation that had arisen in the desert, Western desert, between O'Connor and Wilson, which I think I talked about previously. But Alexander looked upon himself as an independent commander. Which in fact he really was. And in any way, he was in direct communication with Alan Brooke and with the Prime Minister was in direct communication with him, put it that way. And so, I don't think, I give Jumbo Wilson his due. He didn't try to interfere or intervene unduly, I don't think. Occasionally, there was some irritation or disagreement, but it usually resolved itself. It didn't damage the friction, such friction as there was, or such disagreement. I think there's better word than friction. Such disagreement as there was didn't, in my opinion, damage the conduct of the campaign.
Could I now ask you about the Anzio landing and how this worked in with the push forward?
Well, as I explained, after my first initiation to the situation and the meeting, and particularly the meeting at Marrakesh with the Prime Minister, I was very anxious indeed about the Anzio operation, about its chances of success. And I felt that there wasn't enough follow-up resources. And so for that, I arranged to bring over, I think certainly one, if not two divisions from the 8th Army to as follow-up divisions for the landing. I was also concerned and worried and anxious about the command because on one occasion, before the operation was in the planning stage, I went to a meeting at which General Lucas, who was to command the operation, the American general who was to command the operation, was discussing his plans with some of his staff and subordinates. And I went and I just listened in to that meeting, and I wasn't at all happy about it, because it seemed to me that the that General Lucas had not got his heart in the job. He was very anxious, and I think naturally anxious about the chances of success. And he was quite determined that he wasn't going to be, it wasn't going to be a failure under his command. In other words, I didn't think he had the what Monty used to describe as the light of battle in his eyes, and thought he was going, he was over cautious, and this in fact turned out to be the case. And I came back and told Alexander of my anxieties, and he came to the conclusion that I said I thought that he ought to be changed. I think I, for the best of my recollection, I think I said that to Alexander. But he came to the conclusion that all this business of fighting on an Allied basis, it would be wrong for him to press Mark Clark to make a change at that stage in the operation. And so that was that. I think it was a mistake. I think that there should have been, looking back on it all, I think I should have pressed Alexander to have a thorough discussion with Mark Clark about it, and to hammer it out, to make it clear to Mark Clark that he, Alexander, hadn't got complete confidence in Lucas, and that therefore some change should be made, if necessary, delaying the operation accordingly. But I didn't do so, and I think I was wrong not to do so. And so nothing was done, and Lucas was left in command. There have been a lot of arguments and differences of opinion. I think somebody recently written a book where he said that which argued that it was it would have been a mistake for Lucas to be more aggressive and enterprising. He would have had a bloody nose, and the whole thing would have been a failure. And we would not have been left even with a bridgehead. I don't agree with that. And it was a difficult operation. It was the American troops who were involved, and the British troops too, were new to combined operations. And they did bog down the bridgehead. The Germans were very quick in reinforcing their holding operation. They sent Goring Division and others. They sent some of their most experienced battle experienced troops to hold the landing and to encircle it, and they were successful in doing that. And they had the advantage of the ground. I mean, the Auburn Hills overlooking the landing area and the bridgehead around Cisterna. And they were that was a very skillful and effective and successful operation on the part of Kesselring and the German High Command.